But how about we start with doing some practice? So invite everybody to find a comfortable sitting posture. Okay. In my case, that's not exactly possible since I'm sitting in a straight chair with very little padding, but that can give me something to focus on while we sit. Right, so settle in, get centered and relaxed, at ease. Let the body maybe relax just a notch or two more than it is now. And then with our arms relaxed at our sides and our hands folded in the lap or maybe resting on the legs. And then allowing the eyes to gently close. The attention to come to rest on the breathing. We may notice the breathing mostly as the air moving in and out of the nostrils, maybe the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the surface of the ocean on a calm day. Feeling the pressure of the body on your cushion, on your chair, feeling its solidity. Understanding that this pressure, this contact, this feeling of solidity and connection is an expression of the affinity between the center of gravity of your body and the center of gravity of the earth. 4,000 miles below you. Understanding this feeling as being rooted in the earth, of being of the earth element in our being. Feeling the sensation of moisture in the mouth. Reminder that 70% of our body mass is made up of liquid. Just as 70% of the Earth's surface is covered with water. And the salinity of the oceans is the same as the salinity of the liquids in our own body. Feeling the sensation of moisture and knowing the water element within us. Feeling our bodies rhythmically expanding and contracting with each in-breath and each out-breath as the air moves to and fro, in and out. The air moves all around us, even as it moves within us, drawing in nourishment carrying away that which we no longer need. Nourishing and cleansing the wind element that we share with all beings, nourishing each other. All green plants on the earth giving us what we need, and we giving them what they need. A partnership that sustains life for both. Feeling the pulsing of the cardiovascular system within our bodies. The rhythmic pulsation that moves the fluids about, carries the blood to be oxygenated by the wind element, then carries it throughout the body. Feeling the energy element within us, just as we feel the sun shining down on all creation, on all beings, on all things, infusing us and all things with the pulsating energy of the universe, the energy element, the fire element. Earth, water, wind, and fire. That which is within us being the same as that which is around us. Not separate. Not two. In rhythmic union. Knowing our place in this universe, feeling it and being it. Bodily sensations or sounds or thoughts or emotions arise as we sit, understanding them to be nothing more than expressions of energy. Flickerings of the fire element within us, like flickering flames. They arise, brightly shine, put off energy and heat, and then pass away. All of these phenomena, in their turn, as the mind attends to them, arising and changing, and passing away. Not just being in the flow of nature, but being the flow of nature itself. fame and shame, praise and blame, come and go like the wind, to be happy, rest like a great tree in the midst of them all. Okay, let's take a short stretch break, and then I'll bring the banjo again, and we can get together for a little talk and some discussion. Well, there's something about being down here in the San Luis Valley right now that got me to thinking about some of the commonalities that we have with the wildlife and just the lovely natural setting that we find ourselves living in here in Colorado. And there is a particular concept having to do with animal behavior and not just, you know, wild animals in natural settings, but us too, that has fascinated me for a very long time, from my very earliest days studying systems ecology, ecosystem management, and animal behavior, then on to planning, and then later on to spiritual inquiry, especially Taoism and Buddhism. There is this concept that's always sort of fascinated me, and it's this through line, it's this nexus that I have found equally applicable in all these different realms. And it's known in the literature as the concept of the principle of refuge and prospect. It's a very common behavioral pattern amongst and way of interacting with the world that's common to almost a great many animal species. In essence, the concept means that it's in the nature of most beings in the animal realm, in terms of interaction with the environment, to have a setting that provides two distinct but complementary qualities. They're called refuge and prospect. The concept means having a place of shelter and safety from which to survey one's surroundings for both threats and opportunities. So, for instance, there are prairie dog towns that you may encounter from time to time, either out in the open or in zoos like the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum. Prairie dogs are very good at creating refuge. They excavate these underground villages, you know, with burrows and tunnels and crevices and hiding holes and multiple means of escape. And they, you know, hundreds of them may create one of these villages. And they have chambers for storing food, and they have chambers that are basically privies. They have other chambers where young are born and nurtured, they excavate so much earth in order to create this habitat. They pile it up in mounds around the prairie dog town, and there are designated members of the group who act as sentinels. So while everyone else is out foraging, you know, eating grass and gathering seeds and things like that, these prairie dogs stand guard. And so they are sort of guarding the refuge. And they're, in terms of prospect, what they're mostly do is scanning the environment for threat. And so whenever it looks like they're about to undergo an aerial attack, you know, from raptors or whatever, ground attack from coyotes or whatever, then these sentinels send out these warning signals and everyone runs back into the burrow again. So they created this very secure refuge for themselves, except for the odd snake. And in terms of prospect, they're principally looking out for possible threats to their well-being. So that's on the sort of the prey side. On the predator side, especially out here, a lot of raptors of hawks and falcons. And the raptors' place of refuge is usually nests high in trees, or sometimes an area, you know, a place where, like a crevice or something high on a rocky ledge where no one can get to them, from which they can kind of survey the surroundings for prospects for something to eat. And out at Bar Lake State Park, for instance, where we have prairie dogs, we also have a lot of raptors. There's a falcon species out there that they soar at pretty high levels, high altitudes, you know, over us. And their eyesight is such that they can see prey about a mile away. And then when they see something that looks like might be good for lunch, they go in a really steep dive at 270 miles an hour. And like if they're you know, diving into a prairie dog town, oftentimes they nail one of the sentinels since they're standing up tall and whatnot. But it's the same principle. They have their place of refuge and then they go out, they have a lot of prospects from which to feed. With early humans, it was no different. many of them hung out in shallow caves on hillsides or mountainsides, from which they were relatively safe from large predators and had a really sweeping view of their surroundings for hunting purposes. Medieval castles, you know, on mountain tops here and there around Europe, you can see they're usually built someplace high up and they're tall, so the people standing on top can, you know, see a long ways to see, you know, if they're getting ready to mount an expedition, what they might run into out there, or if someone's coming after them, then they can know to fortify themselves. So refuge and prospect. The application to spiritual inquiry, spiritual practice that has struck me the most. I did some, you know, tantric yoga, but then I got way into Taoism for a while. And studying like Chinese landscape paintings, for instance. If you look at a painting by somebody like Bierstadt or somebody that did these 19th century naturalistic paintings of the Mountain West and whatnot, you'll see that their point of view is usually they're down in a valley and they're looking up at these mountain peaks around them. And in Chinese landscape painting, it's different. The perspective, the place from which the painter is looking at the landscape is high up. It's a place of refuge. And their paintings are of prospects. They're looking sort of from above down on, you know, pagodas or things that may be built into a hillside or valleys and farmlands and whatnot. So it's a somewhat different view. Okay. The Buddha, when he talked about refuge, right, being a refuge unto yourself, it was creating within ourselves a safe place from which to view the world in terms of threats and opportunities, but to be able to do so with a certain sense of equanimity. So There's a poet named Li Po from about the 8th century. Excuse me. Li Po lived in China around the 8th century of the Common Era. And it was a time after which samadhi-based Buddha Dharma had been introduced into China, had become thoroughly intertwined with Taoism, and had created Xuan Buddhism, which in Japan would later be called Zen. And so a lot of his poems are born out of the Xuan Buddhist experience. So this poem is called Gazing at the Lu Mountain Waterfall. And there are a couple of concepts, idioms he uses there. One, he talks about Incense Burner Peak, which is actually an actual mountain in eastern China. And it's a great high mesa, and there's a lake in the middle of it at the very top. And given what the weather may be up to, sometimes at dawn, there's a lot of mist that rises off the lake, and it looks like an incense burner. And so Incense Burner Peak is in this poem. And then he also uses this term, Star River. And Star River, his poem and his poetry, is the Milky Way in the summer sky. It looks like a river of stars, you know, floating across the sky. So, climbing west toward Incense Burner Peak, I look south and see a falls of water, a cascade hanging there, 3,000 feet high, then seething dozens of miles down canyons. So he's up on a high mountain peak himself, looking down, looking around. Okay. Sudden as lightning breaking into flight, the plunging waters, a white rainbow of mystery appears. Afraid at first the celestial Star River is falling, splitting and dissolving into cloud heavens, I look into force, churning in strength, all the power of the very workings of the Tao. It keeps ocean winds blowing ceaselessly, shines a mountain moon back into the empty space. Empty space it tumbles and sprays through, rinsing green cliffs clean on both sides, sending pearls and flights scattering into the mist, and white water seething down towering rocks. Here, after wandering among these renowned mountains, the heart grows rich with repose. Why talk of cleansing elixirs of immortality? Here, the world's dust is rinsed from my face. I'll stay close to what I've always loved, content to leave that peopled world forever. Sunlight on incense burner kindles violet smoke. Watching the distant falls hang there, river headwaters plummeting 3,000 feet in flight, I see Star River falling through nine heavens. So there are these mountain monasteries all over eastern China, and he would hike from one to another and write a poem at each one. So here he is on this mountain peak. He's seeing this water flowing, this huge, deep waterfall, plunging down into these canyons and the mist rising, and then looking up into the sky in the evening, you know, it looks to him as if this mist is rising up into the sky and becoming the Milky Way, becoming Star River, right? Mm. And then again, plunging down. So he's looking at this, he's looking at the universe as he understands it, you know, this great cosmic flow of energy of which he's a part. So he's in his place of refuge in the mountain temple, and he's, you know, the prospect that he sees is infinity, you know, and he sees himself as not being separate, you know. So the refuge and prospect in these teachings can be one of being, you know, in the place of mindfulness, in a place of peace and openness, and the prospect is one of vastness. But there's another way that it works as well. This is what is striven for a lot of spiritual practitioners, that this is what it's all about, and this is what we pray, this is what we long for. But there's another way that it can be understood as well. So this is a passage that I've read before that some of you may recognize. It's from a book called Kitchen Table Wisdom by Rachel Rimmon. Rachel is a physician practicing at University of California, San Francisco Medical Center, who became gravely ill. I think it was cancer. And she was treated by her colleagues there, and she eventually came through and regained her health. And she said that as a result of the experience, she was profoundly grateful to her colleagues and for medical science for having been able to cure her, basically, of her cancer. But she also was really struck, as is the case in certainly several indigenous cultures I'm aware of the distinction between curing and healing. Healing means to make whole. And so what she felt is something that's commonly expressed in a variety of other cultures, including indigenous ones, that when one becomes ill, it's not just a matter of some malfunction of systems in the body. It's if you were had been taken apart, had been somehow sort of obliterated in a way, and the symptoms of the illness can be treated. That's where the curing comes in. But she said that the healing is about making oneself whole again. So in her case, she was able to be cured of the cancer that she had, but she realized that there was still a lot of healing to do. And when she talks about healing and the way she has since worked with it, with people who, you know, are facing life-threatening illnesses that they may or may not survive, they may or may not be cured of. She says that whatever goes on in terms of the curing, the healing is always a possibility. The coming together, becoming whole again, whatever it is that happens with the body, if indeed one is feeling shattered by the experience of illness, you know, that it is possible to regain a place of spiritual refuge and peace, whatever happens with the malady. So in this passage, she says, in a book about Spain, I remember reading an interesting thing about bullfighting. There is a place in the bull ring where the bull feels safe. If he can reach this place, he stops running and can gather his full strength. He's no longer afraid. From the point of view of his opponent, he becomes dangerous. This place in the ring is different for every bull. It's the job of the matador to be aware of this, to know where the sanctuary lies for each and every bull, to be sure the bull does not occupy his place of wholeness. In bullfighting, the safe place is called the cadencia. For humans, the cadencia is a place in our inner world. Often it is a familiar place that has not been noticed until a time of crisis. Sometimes it is a viewpoint, a position from which to conduct a life. different for each person. Often it is simply a place of deep inner silence. One of the meditations I've done with people with cancer begins with the suggestion, find a safe place. A man newly diagnosed with colon cancer once told me the following. I never got into the exercise because I could not find a safe place to begin. I looked everywhere. I imagined myself in my home. I imagined myself trout fishing. I imagined myself behind my desk, at my business, or at the head of the table in the boardroom. Nothing helped. In the midst of this, I realized this sort of searching was familiar. I'd been doing it all my life. I began to feel desperate. In the end, I imagined myself a little boy in my mother's arms. This last helped. Slowly, I began to feel calmer, to get quieter inside, and when at last I felt safe, I suddenly knew the arms around me were not my mother's, but my own. The place of safety is inside me, not outside where I have been looking all my life. All those hiding places, all those achievements, it's inside me. That's why I never found it before. In working with people with cancer, I have seen the changes which happen when a person finds their querencia. In full view of the matador, they are calm and peaceful and wise. They have gathered their strength around them. The inner silence is more secure than any hiding place. So, in some ways, this is what Dharma practice is all about, you know? It's finding the cadencia. And I looked up the word in my Spanish dictionary. It means a place where wild animals go to feel safe. Okay, habitat, you know, in the wilderness. So in when I was learning practice of Tai Chi and other Chinese martial art kung fu, there are these lists of movements that you do in sequence. And then at the end of it, the last movement, the last line in the instruction is return to center. You know? And the Tai Chi master that I was learning from, you know, he was always talked about the importance of this center, the Tan Tian. It's right around the navel. It's the center of gravity of the body. And he said that's where the wisdom lies, and that's where the knowing how to move and when lies as well. You know, that the activity and the action, and Tai Chi is a defensive martial art, so it's primarily about creating this realm or this aura of safety around you. So that it all emanates from this still place in the center, you know, and keeping your balance, keeping your wits about you, is all about remembering that place, remembering where you came from. When I was still working at the University of Colorado, I had a project that I ran for the National Park Service, where I trained American Indian College students to serve as cultural resource interpreters at parks and monuments that their tribes had a traditional cultural affiliation with. And one of my students was placed at Natural Bridges National Monument in southeastern Utah, near Blanding. And he was talking to me about this sort of sacred terrain, this area, you know, with Blanca Peak and Mount Taylor and the San Francisco Peaks and Mount Hesperus. And he said, within in the eastern end, northeastern end of the Navajo Reservation, there is this particular valley It's called the Valley of the Warriors. And when, he said in the old days, when the warriors were going forth, you know, in defense of the reservation and whatnot, they would go first to this valley within, you know, this sacred terrain. And the elders would say, this is your center, this is your place, this is where you come from as you go forth, you know, to fulfill the warrior's task. Remember this place, remember where you came from. And he said that in World War II, all the Navajo code talkers went to this valley and underwent this ritual. And when they were in the field in the Pacific Islands, you know, and they were, reason that they were using him was because the Japanese were never able to figure out the Navajo language. So it was a highly secure way to communicate over the radio. But he said that one of the things that really seemed to help them stay level-headed and keep their cool and stay focused is sort of remembering that place, remember where you came from. So I've found that to be kind of interesting. Here in the San Luis Valley, it's a really extraordinary place. Real whole area is kind of a power spot. But there's Blanca Peak on the southwest flank of the peak is Zapata Falls. It's really kind of magical waterfall. It's a series of waterfalls. And then further north is Great Sand Dunes National Park. And then the San Luis Valley National Wildlife Refuge, you know, where the sandhill cranes come. So there are all these kind of wonderful things you can do out in this expansive, energy-charged area when the circumstances are present themselves a little bit like Lipo's, you know, home. But yesterday afternoon and evening, it was like this black curtain had been drawn across the sky, and we have a little complex of, you know, my sister's cabin is right next to me, and there's a little kitchen in there, and then my kuti is just a meeting place and a place for practice, and the wind got stronger and stronger and stronger, and there was a lot of lightning, and so it's, you didn't feel quite like, you know, a thunderstorm moving over our house in Denver. It's, we're really kind of on the edge of the wilderness here, and it's this really primitive little structure. It's really tight. I mean, it you know, it's stood up to the weather here for 15 years without, you know, any untoward event. But I was in here and I was looking around. I was seeing all the trees being bent sideways and the rain pelting and nearby lightning strikes. And it was extremely humbling. It wasn't frightening exactly, but in terms of refuge and prospect, you know, the very prospect of going outside or going out to the other cabin where the food is, it was pretty daunting. And so I just stayed in here, you know. And the Buddha said, you know, when you're doing mindfulness meditation, he said, go into the forest and sit at the base of a tree or in a hut or some solitary place. And establish inner refuge. And that's riding out the storm, just watching it in awe, you know. I felt that, you know. It wasn't the vastness going out and hiking and, you know, beautiful terrain on a nice day. It was, you know, Buddha said, the meditator knows the expansive mind to be the expansive mind, knows the contracted mind to be the contracted mind. So I was feeling pretty contracted, you know. I was feeling very grateful to be in this silent, still, safe place. You know, it was a very effective shelter from the storm, even as the storm was roiling all around me, you know, and there was no question of going out. It was just a matter of being there with it. So, remembering, you know, for me, I think for our practice generally, as much as anything else, whether we're doing metta or we're doing inside practice or deep samadhi or watching the breathing, ultimately, regardless of whatever practice it might be, I think it's the place from which the practice is coming. You know, that just like Rachel said, you know, about, you know, her patients being able to find the place of peace, the place of silence, the place of refuge, the place from which it's possible to see prospect, to see the prospect of the pleasant, the prospect of the unpleasant, to feel the pleasant, to feel the unpleasant, and yet not be overwhelmed by them. You know, that's the essence of equanimity. Experience the pleasant without attachment and the unpleasant without aversion. Because the experiencing is coming from a very deep, silent place, place of refuge. So those are my thoughts for the evening. Would anyone else like to share theirs? Yeah. Questions or comments? Well, we don't have to just sit here and look at each other for half an hour. So if you'd like to go out and watch the beautiful sunset, we can do that. And we can. Yeah, please.
You know, I've been in that part of the state, and it's remarkable. Crestone.
Yes.
I used to say Crestone is hovering 3 feet off the ground. There's so many spiritual centers of so many different spiritual paths there. My favorite as a Catholic Christian was the Carmelite community, De Nava.
Yes.
I think it recently closed because they need a new generation of monastics.
Yes.
So to restart it. But I think the chapel will still be there. I don't think they're going to take that down. I hope not. Every time I've been in that chapel to meditate and just be there, I've just wept silently. The tears come from this deep place inside. And I think it's just the aura of that whole community is just steeped in deep mystical mystery, paradox, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. The land there are 20,000 acres of land there. It was once owned by a wealthy man as an undersecretary of the UN named Maurice Strong. And what he did, he and his wife, was that they established this kind of land grant program where they invited different wisdom traditions to come there and set up retreat centers and in some cases communities. And so there is, like you said, there is a really interesting array of spiritual practice opportunities. There are two different Tibetan teachers. The one I know is Sokni Rinpoche, the Dzogchen master. In fact, his Western seat is in Crestone. His other one is, you know, on the border between Tibet and Nepal. And a dear friend of mine is sort of been his administrator for a very long period of time. And he said he really found the valley and especially the area around Crestone appealing because it reminded him so much of Tibet. And here, you know, where we are, my sister and I are looking to do some landscaping on our property now. And so we've been, and we wanted to use we want to use natural vegetation, but we're working with the owner of a nursery in town, and she said, you know, if you really do want large shrubs and trees, she said the only species that I've ever found that really thrives here are all native to Siberia. The Siberian elm, the Siberian tea brush, that's what we're going to be planting, because once they get started, once they have enough water, they can kind of take care of themselves, and there's almost nothing else out here to last.
I just wanted to finish my thought on the chapel.
Yeah, please.
The chapel is not overtly Christian. It is Christian. It's a Christian place. It's a very progressive Catholic, you know, monastic place. But they have sort of adopted some of the other, as you would say, the wisdom traditions of that community along with it. But it's just, I was always amazed. And then I would make a tour up the mountain of all these stupas.
Yes.
And it was
And the Crestone Zen Center is there as well. Has a beautiful Zendo, wonderful place to go practice. Yes, there really is something about the environment that lends itself to going deep, going inside. The place is inviting and it's energy charged at the same time. It can be quite inspirational. So yeah, thanks for saying something. Well, very well then, my friends. Why don't we settle back into our sitting posture?
May I see?
Yeah.
I wondered if you'd seen this book, Finding the Mother Tree, by this Suzanne Simard, who studied the interactions among the trees and found that they actually supplied things for each other, and the whole forest is underlaid with a network of microorganisms with various functions. We even go across species to help other trees in times of drought or whatever is happening. And it's really remarkable.
Oh, I have it. I'm reading it now. It's probably one of the best, one of the more powerful, very recent additions to the conservation literature that I'm aware of. You know, I think it bears some of the same, has some of the same characteristics as Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, I think. And in part for some of the same reasons, you know. Rachel Carson was ostracized, she was ridiculed, completely stigmatized by the scientific community. Much of which was funded by agribusiness, you know, at the time. And she just called everything into question in a major way. And Suzanne Simard was the same way. And she started off working for lumber companies and this, said, I can't do this. And so she began her research on mycorrhizal fungi and how they are basically the nervous system of the entire forest. And it's a very inspirational read. And over the course of her 30 years or so in the profession, she has revolutionized the practice of forest ecology and sustainable forest management. And when I think about some of the people who I know who have been influenced by her work, you know, and the way she's sent her research basically brought clear cutting to an end. In the United States, they still do it in Canada, but when I see the impact that she's had just from telling the truth over and over again, even as she was being ridiculed and ostracized and stigmatized, just like Rachel Carson was, what I came to realize just in looking at her career and looking at her impact and reading her book, she's a mother tree. She's been putting out this research all this time that people are just going, whoa, you know, and it's awakened a whole new generation of forest ecologists and forest management in the United States is never going to be the same after this book. It's a wonderful piece of work. Anyone else with anything to share? Okay. Let's settle in and find our sitting posture then, please. Allow the eyes to gently close. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Pava tu sava mangalam rakam tu sava devata. Sava bhuta nubhavena. Sada sote bhavantute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Pava tu sava mangalam rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava dhamandu bhavena sada sati bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavati sava mangalam rakanti sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava sangha nubhavena sada sati bhavantute. By the power of all the sangha, may you always be well. Bhavati sava mangalam rakanti sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Go in peace, my friends. Remember your place of refuge and have a good week.
Thank you, Dear Lloyd.
Thank you, Dear Lloyd.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Thank you, Dear Lloyd.
Thank you, Dear Lloyd.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Tara Lloyd, what would you like to call your talk?
Refuge and Prospect.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. How do you spell Xuan in Xuan Buddhism?
Usually I've seen it spelled C-H-U-A-N.
Okay, thank you.
Sometimes somebody puts an apostrophe after the H, but usually not, just Xuan.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, good night, everybody.
Good night.